I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. High school athletes in Missouri don't have to get a health screening as often as they used to. That's because of a new rule change, which only requires a physical exam every 2 years instead of one. Today, the teenage body undergoes many physical and mental changes in 2 years' time, so does making the switch away from annual checkups threaten a young athlete's health? Then, we're tracing the story of La Bohème, from its origins as a collection of stories in 19th century France to a more recent form in Jonathan Larson's iconic American musical, Rent. Next month, Puccini's version hits the stage at Kansas City's Lyric Opera. We'll get you up to date after the news. Once upon a time, Missouri required high school athletes to undergo a physical exam each year. No more. The requirement changed in May and now allows athletes to get a physical once every 2 years. Some pediatricians call that a big mistake. They say too much physical and emotional development takes place in high school bodies from year to year. Skipping a physical eliminates the opportunity to screen for issues like anorexia or even depression. Now a conversation about why the change was made and whether it was the right thing to do. With us, Dr. Greg Canty is medical director of the Children's Mercy Sports Medicine Center and serves on the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee for the Missouri State High School Activities Association. Dr. Canty, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Steve.
And also back again is Dr. Natasha Burgert. She's a regular guest on our Children's Health and Development series. She's with Pediatric Associates on the Plaza, which is opening a third location in the Blue Hawk development at 159th and Highway 69. It's going to be called Pediatric Associates South Overland Park. Dr. Burgert, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Great to be back. Thanks, Steve.
Dr. Canty, why did the High School Association make this change to just one physical every 2 years?
Well, I think it extends back for a couple of reasons. I think one is it has long been standing that the high school physical doesn't have to be done every year for sports participation. The organizations that put together the PPE that's published, the PPE stands for pre-participation exam, but have long supported that this exam could be done every 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically we've adopted that philosophy for a couple of things. One, I think our biggest emphasis is to try to drive people to a medical home. What we'd really like to have them do is get their sports physical as part of their ongoing health care within their medical home. The hope is that if you get one every 2 years, that there's no excuses not to have that done within a medical home. We wanted to avoid that fall back to school rush where people were running off to get physicals at urgent care of, mm-hmm. A place that was not really designed to do the proper pre-participation and really general health exam. And that's what we were trying to promote, that medical home model, I believe.
So it's kind of counterintuitive. You're actually trying to encourage people to get physicals more often by making the requirement once every 2 years instead of every year.
Yeah, we wanted this to be something where you were engaged in your own health care, not just getting a checkbox of, I got to have my sports physical.
Right.
And I worry sometimes that I see families, they feel that the sports physical is all the health care that they need.
Mm-hmm.
I know as a pediatrician and a sports medicine physician that this exam was designed. If you look at where the pre-participation exam originated, this goes way back to, to break out the history books. I mean, this really started back in World War II when people were coming into the military and they had some physical problems that the military wanted to get worked out before they joined. And so they were trying to recognize these things early. That grew into I think in the 60s was when the AMA kind of instituted and started this pre-participation exam that centered a little bit around sports. It's evolved since then. And now there's a book that's published regularly that we have here. It's now in the fifth edition, and it's kind of endorsed by the five major sports societies.
All right. Dr. Burgert, how controversial a call was this by the association?
I don't know how controversial it was, because quite honestly, a lot of us pediatricians were like the last to know. A lot of times the sports physical form kind of came in with that edit on the bottom saying that only had to be every 2 years. And quite honestly, a lot of us were taken back by this because historically we're used to seeing our student athletes every year. And that's kind of been the rhythm of our flow.
Right.
And I completely agree with Dr. Canny that the best place for those should be in the medical home. But in this situation, I feel like we were a little bit hoodwinked.
And do you also think that, there'll be some athletes who won't get a physical or won't see a doctor more often than once every 2 years? Is there a potential for problems there?
Well, I think so. I think the pre-participation physical is one way that we can see our adolescents. Kids are fortunately super healthy. They don't come to the doctor very often. And it's one way for us to have a requirement, or at least encourage the requirement for those that are playing sports to bring their kids to the doctor annually. We still miss a ton of kids. There's, not everybody plays sports. And, mm-hmm. But it does allow us to get a large cohort of our adolescents into the doctor during 4 years of their life when they are physically and emotionally changing so drastically and becoming young adults. And really preparing them for adult health care. There's a lot of stuff that happens in that 4 years.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that if pediatricians had been aware this change was in the works, you guys might have spoken out against it.
I mean, I can't speak for all of my colleagues, but it would be certainly something that I would question. And not to the point where, like, a pre-participation physical, to Dr. Canny's point, that, checking to see if your arms and legs work, I agree. It's probably not needed every single year for these high-level student athletes. These kids, like I said, are healthy and well. But as a parent of a preteen, I don't get the opportunity to do a full exam or really have private time, talk about mental health issues, talk about high-risk things. When we're talking about gun violence in Kansas City, we're talking about vaping. Like, these are the places that we get to have these conversations, and they're fueled from the doctor's office. We can sit around and say, hey, let's mom, dad, kids all together. Hey, do you know this is a really big problem at your school that everyone's vaping? Have you guys talked about this?
Right.
That doesn't have – nobody is going to make a doctor's appointment to come and talk about that stuff, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times it is those pre-participation physicals that we find things on children. We find anorexia. We find self-harm. We find significant dating relationships, dating violence. We're finding these things that otherwise parents would not bring their kids into. And as someone who cares deeply about the kids who I care for, I really feel only seeing them twice, essentially, during their high school career, potentially missing some major issues in which preventative care is vitally important within the medical home.
Dr. Canty, maybe one of the issues here is, what kind of physical are we talking about here? Because when I was in sixth grade, the physical was, 30 boys standing around in a circle and a doctor coming in and taking all of, 10 minutes to run through physicals for each of us, which were, cursory exams at best. When we talk about high school physicals, what are we talking about?
I think that's a great question, Steve, and I think that's one of the things where the lines get blurred here a little bit, is in that in the past, I believe people have depended upon their healthcare interaction being based just on the PPE.
PPE being the physical.
The PPE means the pre-participation exam for sports.
Right.
And so this is not, and this is one of the problems that I have, is that I believe too many people replace an annual physical by thinking the PPE, the sports physical exam, is adequate. Mm-hmm. And all of the things that Dr. Berger just spoke about very eloquently, I think, are extremely important. Those are not included mm-hmm. as part of the sports PPE exam.
So it's a pretty cursory exam is what
Correct.
You're saying. Oftentimes done in a group setting?
It can be. And so the patients that are coming into the office, I think, are the ones that are getting well served. Those are the patients that someone such as Dr. Berger's talking to them about the other things that affect adolescents, whether it's vaping, mental health,
It's a one-on-one conversation is what Dr. Berger's talking
correct,
about.
Correct. Yeah. And what we worry about is too many of these are not being done in that situation, in that scenario. I worry about the young athletes, the young patients, the families who are rather proud, and we're giving them a little bit of some false security in that they feel like I just had my exam for the year in this very sports PPE, which is designed just to see, could you participate in sports safely? We don't want that to be a barrier. We want the kids to participate in sport. That markedly increases their opportunities to get physical activity, their opportunities to meet physical activity right. guidelines every year. So we want that barrier to be somewhat low. We want it just to be able to, they can safely participate. And the biggest issue with that is cardiac concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so a brief musculoskeletal screen, cardiac history, a cardiac exam, those are some of the main tenets. And this PPE is, I believe, each and every edition that comes out is has more and more focused kind of recommendations than the one before that. But the PPE itself is not based on a ton of evidence. This has kind of become a cultural thing over the years. It lacks a strong evidence-based medicine backing.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about how often high school athletes in Missouri have to get a physical. The guidelines have changed recently. Now it's once every 2 years instead of every year. If you have a question about this, our phone number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Dr. Berger, you know, one issue it strikes me here is cost. You know, if you're going to drive high school athletes into the doctor's office, you know, some kids can't afford to come have a one-on-one consultation with a doctor that lasts half an hour. And I'm wondering, you know, what happens then?
No, that's a great point. And that's certainly one of the benefits of stretching out this guideline to every 24 months. And I completely agree. Sports have so many benefits for our kids, even well beyond the physical benefit that they get. And so we want our kids participating and being multidimensional. And not only the cost, but the time. Like, it's hard to find the time, not only to get time on my books as a pediatrician, but just time in your busy families to
right.
come in. And so I do think that allowing a little bit of a stretch time to be able to decrease that the cost burden and the what some might consider an inconvenience to come into the doctor just to get your form signed.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly has some validity if the message is still consistent that coming in for an annual exam for your physician is when you are able and maybe a little bit more flexible on your own time is still important. My fear is that and what I've heard in the office is mm-hmm. now they get the new form and they look at it and they're like, oh, great, I don't have to see you for a couple of years. I'm like, No, we still want to see you next year. We still got some stuff.
Dr. Canty, what do you do with high school students who go to the coach and say, coach, I can't afford to get in to see the doctor?
It's a challenge. And I think that as a sports medicine practitioner, my goal is to try to be able to encourage that sports participation. And I think that we find this because we work with a number of socioeconomic disadvantaged athletes in the Kansas City region. And I think far more times than not, there is an opportunity there for you to get good health care. It's just helping you find the right spot to go.
But does the association have some kind of program that will pay for students to cover the cost of a physical?
No.
Okay, and that's an issue.
We think it's an issue with certain families that, yeah, so I guess the answer, I'm not for sure I have a great answer for your question,
right.
but I think cost is always a question in our healthcare.
Sure, of course.
So I think trying to basically get barriers, what we found in the past, though, is that folks were going out to the least common denominator.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting a physical for, well, let's see, is it $20 or it's $25 here? And they were having some false security that physical replaced the excellent physical that Dr. Berger's describing that would take place in her office.
Yeah.
And we don't want that to be the case.
Maybe we should be really clear here, Natasha. You know, what would you examine in a young athlete, a young high school student that might not get examined in a physical exam that's being done for sports participation? What kinds of things might you look at?
Well, I think the huge one for my teenage right now is mental health. Like,
yeah.
Like,
okay.
I think that's absolutely
Can you
important.
Tell something in a half-hour physical exam? Can you figure something out?
For mental health
yes.
for kids? Absolutely.
Yeah.
We have the checkups that we do now today have even morphed in my small 10 years of being a pediatrician, have even developed into really looking at whole child wellness. We're asking about high-risk behaviors, of course. We're looking at the physical body, but we're really passionate about, especially in Kansas City and Johnson County with super high suicide rates,
right.
like mental health is the top of the list. But it is also, you know, I think as a parent myself, like I don't examine my child. I don't see, as privacy increases, I honestly don't see them very much anymore, right?
Yeah, I know that
yeah,
feeling.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So how on earth can we not have an opportunity for an independent party, a professionally trained person with a high level of discretion be able to look completely at the physical body of a teenager. To an extent, they hide a lot of stuff, and we find it.
I was going to say, teenagers are pretty private. To what extent will they disclose to you that the athlete, he or she, is having some mental health struggles?
That's a perfect question. To Dr. Caney's point, they're not going to disclose anything if it's just a one-off urgent care or if it's just a one-off, you know, circle right. around and talk to the doc for a cursory exam. But I'm very privileged and very fortunate that for the vast majority of kids in our city who can have a true medical home where they know that physician, they tell me amazing stories. Not just stuff that's like bad and patients or parents worry about. They're telling me about their cool high school projects, and they're telling me about these amazing college experiences,
wow.
and all this kind of stuff. We develop a professional friendship over those first
right.
over those 4 years. So when a crisis hits, or if a crisis hits, we are there as a known player in their healthcare, and we are there to help catch them when they fall. But that cannot happen if people are doing PPEs at various centers.
Yeah.
So globally, there needs to be a shift. But you would be surprised. And I love my teens. They say amazing things. And even from me sometimes, I'm like, a year is not enough. I have got to figure out what happens here. I really want to know what happens with you.
Right.
And so they check in periodically throughout the year. And that's truly one of the joys of my job.
That's really interesting.
And Steve, to build upon that a little bit, I wanted to make sure we talk about this exam a lot. And I think there are a lot of great strides and changes that were placed into this fifth edition of the PPE. And one of those is the mental health component. We've seen it from the NCAA level down to the high school level to the junior high level, this increase in emphasis on mental health. In the new edition of the sports PPE, there are 4 mental health questions to try to recognize those young athletes who might be at risk for depression, anxiety, and it's designed.
What kinds of things do you ask them? What are the questions?
And so there's an established kind of a questionnaire called the PHQ-4, which asks about days that you feel sad, things that you feel down,
mm-hmm.
Trying to just bring up that conversation.
Right.
Obviously, you know, the days of when we played sports and there's 20 people waiting in the locker room to go by one at a time.
Yes.
That didn't happen. If your young athlete fills out the mental health questionnaire and they come into Dr. Burgert's office, I strongly encourage adoption of this form to be part of your visit,
yeah.
to be the backbone of your visit, considering sports participation. Then she can quickly take a look at that questionnaire and immediately identify, this is a young athlete I need to spend a little more time talking about mental health with, because as I see here, this has flagged some concerns. And so that's one of the things that I think is, you know, we've talked a little bit about the acceptance. I should say acceptance. It's not required that you have this every 2 years. If you are taking care of a young athlete and you have concerns that this patient needs more frequent visits, there is a box that we put in from as part of the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee to recognize you check that box, and this sports physical is only valid for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it allows for the otherwise healthy person 2 years, but if you have concerns, all you have to do is check that box, and that physical is only valid for 1 year.
Oh,
and so it helps supplant some of those concerns.
Right, right.
But I think there's so many good things that came out of this latest edition, and I think some of that it was challenging because it was the first year we've adopted it. In the first year, there's a whole new fifth. This was just published in the spring, and so that's new. There's the acceptance of a 2-year PPE form.
Mm-hmm.
That was new. And so I think it's going to take a year or two for this to kind of settle down. But we felt like the timing of those were both important to kind of rule out to kind of implement together. And so this was the first fall we've kind of gone through that rush. Well, what's this about the 2-year PPE? What's this about
right,
the new forms?
Right, right.
But I think over time, people will look at this PPE and really be impressed to see, okay, here's the checkbox that I only can do it
right.
for 1 year if I have concerns. Here's some great mental health questions to start that conversation. And I think in time, and the people will really find value in that.
I think that that's true. And I appreciate Dr. Caney's passionate work on this with the state because I have seen some institutions that are using the old form and just changing the bottom that says every 2 years. So if this is a policy for your school that you are going to use the every 2 years, the updated form is critical.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Tony from Overland Park. Tony, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the frequency of high school physicals in Missouri. Good morning.
Sure thing. High school coach and teacher, this is my 25th year of teaching. Just want to make sure you guys are aware of what it looks like when you are teaching kids or coaching kids that are disadvantaged. Here's what I did. We worked out a thing where I took my basketball players to a chiropractor, and the chiropractor would fill out the form and charge me $10 a kid. So when we talk about families that are struggling, you know, that falls on the coach then. If the kid can't pay, the question is, how do I I'm sorry, I'm outside. And but how do we pay for this,
right,
if the kid is your best player and or he's a really good, you know, kid, he deserves to play, and there's this limitation of, hey, I got to fill out a form. You know what? The kids at Lee Summit and Blue Valley, they don't have these problems.
Right.
They have access to health care. They have health insurance that pays for it, and they have parents that can pay whatever the cost is.
Right.
In the inner city, I guarantee you, you'd be surprised to find out how many coaches have arranged for a physical to be done and even paid for it. I think you would be absolutely shocked, because it was standard operating procedure where I was. And
Tony, I appreciate it. Let me get a comment from Dr. Canty here. What do you make of that, Dr. Canty? That's a little concerning.
So the first thing I would say is I admire Tony's dedication to helping work with this athletic kind of challenges. But it doesn't replace the fact that what he just described to me is not great health care. And that part to me concerns me a little bit, because this is exactly the thing that I think that having in the situation he just described, let's talk about a four-year health career, I would far rather his athletes go see someone twice over that 4 years and get talks about things that affect adolescents, get talked about what vaccinations an adolescent might need.
Right.
That's not done at a sports physical,
right,
in the situation he's described. The situation he just described concerns me a little bit too. I can't remember.
Is there a way to address it? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Oftentimes what we talk about when we're dealing with a kind of a socioeconomic challenged population, which sounds like Tony is coaching there or speaking with, it's sometimes amazing to find out that folks do have more access to healthcare than they realized, that either the patient didn't realize they actually have a governmental assistance program, or there are places, there are a clinic that would see me with these situations. They haven't really looked at that.
Yeah.
This was just an easy pop-off valve. I can get it done once a year. I can have someone do it. And the situation he describes concerns me. We're talking about a basketball population. There's three things that I worry about. There's the musculoskeletal conditions, and there's a cardiac condition.
Mm-hmm.
The situation he just described is not taking his young athletes to see someone who's
not at all
trained to listen to the heart. And so those historical questions concerning cardiac health are probably some big questions. Those cardiac questions and the musculoskeletal health are the biggest things that we talk about in a sports physical. But that doesn't supplant for the excellent comprehensive physical you should be getting as an adolescent to talk about all the life issues, vaccines that now happen in adolescence. And I think it's just a bigger question.
We're going to have to leave our conversation right there. I want to thank our guest. That was the voice of Dr. Greg Canty. He serves on the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee for the Missouri State High School Activities Association. He's also with Children's Mercy Sports Medicine. Dr. Natasha Burgert is with Pediatric Associates on the Plaza, opening a third location in the Blue Hawk development at 159th and Highway 69. It'll be called Pediatric Associates South Overland Park. Thank you both very much for our conversation. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
After a short break, we'll come back and give you a rundown on everything you wanted to know about La Boheme. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. My email newsletter is dispatched every Monday. If you're not subscribed by now, do it. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up for exclusive content from me and highlights from the Up to Date team. It's a little of me in your inbox each week. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, social media isn't just for being social. One author will explain how right-wing extremists use online platforms to spew propaganda and how they've effectively hijacked the American conversation.
Just
That is soprano Renee Fleming performing one of the most familiar arias in the world, Mosetta's Waltz. As part of Puccini's La Bohème, it and the opera premiered in Italy in 1896. The work became an audience favorite and will become a mainstay of the genre. The Lyric Opera of Kansas City will be performing it next month, and we'll have more on that a bit later. The story of La Bohème didn't begin or end with Puccini. We're going to go back to the original story of the Bohemians and trace its influence into the modern day. Here to help me with this is David Charles Abel. He'll be conducting the Lyric's production of La Bohème. He joins me here in the studio. David, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, 45 years before Puccini's opera, a struggling writer in Paris pens a series of stories about the Bohemian life in Paris, the life that he's actually living. Those stories were the basis of the book, Scenes of Bohemian Life. Puccini wasn't convinced about turning that into an opera. What wound up changing his mind?
Well, part of it was that he had lived that life himself. When he was a young student, he was very, very poor, and he remembered that life. So when he read the book, it really resonated with him. And part of it was his competitiveness. He ran into a fellow composer in a cafe in Milan.
Ah.
And they started talking. And Puccini said, yeah, you know what? I'm working on a version of La Bohème. And Leoncavallo, his friend, said, what? I'm working on a version of La Bohème. And furthermore, last year I wrote a libretto based on La Bohème and I offered it to you to set to music and you turned it down.
Oh, you're
and
kidding.
Here you go writing your own version. So they had this big competition that turned into a co-celebre in the press. And
who would get it done first kind
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And Puccini won that race.
Yeah.
And he said, let the audience decide. And they did. And Puccini's offer is remembered to this day, and Leoncavallo's is pretty much forgotten.
How long did it take for him to be satisfied with the libretto and the music he wrote?
Well, he was all about storytelling. That was his genius. He once said, God touched me with his little finger and said, you will write for the theater, but mind you, only for the theater, because
really?
He was a great musical storyteller. He never wrote a symphony or anything like that, but his operas are our best-loved operas. And so before he even started writing a note, he drove his librettists crazy, you know, the people who were writing the words for him. And months would go by and years, and sometimes the librettist would quit and he'd have to hire another one. So some of the operas have six or seven names down for the libretto. But once he got the story right, then he wrote the music, and that's what gave us these masterpieces.
Tell us the basic story of La Bohème.
Well, it's a story of four bohemians, and, you know, that's sort of code for poor, starving artists.
Mm-hmm.
Four guys who, you know, have no money, but one's a painter, another's a poet, there's a musician, and there's a philosopher. But Puccini focuses really just as much or even more on the love stories. There are two love stories. The poet falls in love with a girl who sews flowers. She makes fake flowers. And in her aria, she says, unfortunately, my flowers have no fragrance. But they have this wonderful romance. And without giving too much away, it is a tragic romance.
Mm.
And there's a secondary romance between the painter and a sort of flirty, gold-digging girl who's very pretty. And that's has a rocky root to it.
I was going to say, David, Puccini was known to focus on the women in his operas. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. I mean, he adored women. He was a bit of a womanizer himself. There was a big scandal with his housekeeper who he seduced, and I think she had a baby. But he also endowed his female characters with great dignity and strength. I mean, Madame Butterfly, which the Lyric Opera did last year, has a very strong central female character who waits for her American husband to come back for 3 years. And Mimi in La Bohème is also very strong in her own way. And our director, Kathleen Belcher, is emphasizing that strength and her, you know, at a time when women didn't have status, the story is set in the 1840s, but she finds a way to, you know, to claim her own power.
Well, La Bohème is considered one of the composer's mature operas. Let's listen to another selection from it, and then you can explain that to us.
Oh,
That's Yes, They Call Me Mimi from Puccini's La Boheme. Now, David, why is this one of the mature operas that he put out?
Well, you can hear the power of the music in that clip, the romance in it. Mm-hmm. And
that's still Renee Fleming, right? Yeah.
No. It sounded like her. Yeah,
yeah. It sounded like her.
Yeah, beautiful. She's one of our great American divas, mm-hmm. you know, the greatest diva of the day. It took him a while to get everything right. A lot of it was the storytelling. He had to get the libretto right, as I was saying before, but also orchestration. He studied Tchaikovsky and Debussy and other great composers of the time, and was very detailed and really spent a lot of time in figuring out how the orchestra was going to help tell the story. Mm-hmm. And this was his second great success. The first one was Manon Lescaut, and then he went on to write Tosca and you know, several of the operas, which are our standards now.
You know, you've mentioned, David, that this cast has the four young Bohemian men, the two women who are love interests here, and there are also four other singing roles, not counting the other members playing residents of Paris. Is this big for an opera or average-sized, or how would you characterize it?
I guess you'd call it a grand opera. I mean, there's a big orchestra. There's a big chorus, which is in a couple of scenes, and a large number of characters. So it's typical for opera. I mean, opera is, you know, a grand art, and it's an expensive art, and that's why we rely on our donors as well as our audience members.
How does the rehearsal process go? I mean, do those with the individual roles learn and practice their parts separately, and then at some point you bring them all together, or
yes,
how does it work?
That's exactly it. These singers work for years to perfect their art. They have to learn Italian. They have to learn the vocal technique of how to produce the sound, how to fill a big concert hall with no microphones. And they have to learn acting, and they learn these specific roles. Then they come in, and they gel within the space of a few days. We've only been rehearsing for a few days now. And the orchestra comes in later. I'll start rehearsing with them next week. And we put it all together. It's a very exciting moment when that all comes together. Then we put it on stage, add the sets, the costumes, the makeup. And finally, it's ready for the audience. It takes about a month.
That's got to be an exciting moment when the orchestra joins the singers. And that's got to be, you can begin to see what you're creating here.
That's everyone's favorite moment. Yeah, that rehearsal.
Wow. When did rehearsal start? About a month ago, you said?
No, we just started a few days ago. The whole process will be about a month.
Wow, okay.
From beginning to end, yeah.
Well, the Lyric Opera of Kansas City presents four performances of La Boheme, November 9th, 13th, 15th, and 17th at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. For more information and tickets, go to kcopera.org. You know, scenes of Bohemian life would continue to inspire. In 1904, a Spanish composer also found fame with his version called Bohemios. Who was this composer?
His name was Amadeo Vives. I don't know much about him, but I think he was the Andrew Lloyd Webber or Lin-Manuel Miranda of his day. Huh. He wrote popular musical theater pieces, equivalent to our Broadway musicals.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to play a piece from this that shows the Spanish influence. It's called The Choir of Bohemians, and here it is.
Y siempre dichosos la vida cruzamos y libres cantamos las glorias de amor y libres cantamos las glorias de amor las glorias de amor al cielo profundo del alma bohemia se siente entre besos la loca pasión.
So, David, that doesn't strike me as a whole lot of opera there, more like musical theater or maybe a little vaudeville in that?
Exactly. Well, this, you know, this composer took Mürger's characters and made it more into a comedy. It's like a Hollywood movie. It's about a composer and a poet who live together in a garret in Paris, and they dream that their works will be performed at the Opéra. And one of their neighbors, Cosette, sounds like Les Miserables, dreams of being a singer. And she comes across the score for the piece that these two are writing by accident. And, of course, she sings it, and she wins the audition, and she becomes a star, and their opera gets performed.
So this is the story sort of the same here, young men and women living a non-conventional lifestyle.
Absolutely, yeah. But this one's sort of like a Hollywood movie.
Yes. Well, this French story then made its way to Italy and then to Spain. It continued to spread its influence, finding its way to a Hungarian composer who was a follower of Puccini. Tell us about him, David, and his version of La Bohème.
Well, his name was Emmerich Kallmann, and he went to Vienna, which was the place to write operettas at the time. He wrote this piece in 1930, and it's called The Violet of Montmartre. The violet refers to the girl. And it's sort of similar to the zarzuela that we just heard. I'll just tell you a little bit about the plot. Three poor friends live together in Montmartre. They welcome the street singer Violet into their home, and she and the painter Raoul fall in love. However, when their friend's former muse Ninon crosses paths with Raoul once again and takes credit for securing him a position at the Louvre, Violet leaves heartbroken. A few months later, the other two friends, Hervé and Murger, are staging an operetta with Ninon in the lead role. When she learns that Raoul doesn't really love her, Ninon leaves. At the last minute, Violet offers to play the part and is reconciled with Raoul. But there's more. Just as she is about to make her entrance, it is revealed that Violet is actually the daughter of a countess. She leaves instantly to find her mother, and Ninon returns to play the role.
So now we know where soap operas in America came from, it sounds like. This has a long history going back a long ways here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the origins of La Bohème, the lyric opera of Kansas City will be presenting four performances of it coming up in November. I'm visiting here with David Charles Abel. He'll be conducting the lyrics production of La Bohème. He's here with me here in the studio. Well, this version actually made it to America under the title of Paris in Spring. Let's listen to another sample from Act One, and here it is. You know, David, that sounds pretty sweet, almost simple. And I always thought that, you know, composers want to challenge musicians and singers with their work. They typically do, don't they?
Well, yeah, but this is popular entertainment. Mm-hmm. This is composers wanting to please their audience, and it's irresistible, isn't it?
It really is.
And it sounds a lot like Hollywood music, doesn't mm-hmm. it? And interestingly, a lot of our Hollywood composers came from Vienna at that time in the 1930s to escape the Nazis. Kalman stayed and wrote operettas. Someone like Erich Wolfgang Korngold went to Hollywood and wrote Errol Flynn scores.
No kidding. Well, La Boheme has had at least one American version with the musical Rent that opened, I think, off-Broadway back in the 1990s. From the original cast album, here's the character Roger singing One Song Glory.
One song, glory, one song before I go. Glory, one song to leave behind. Find one song, one last refrain. Glory, from the pretty boy front man. Wasted opportunity. One song, he had the world at his feet. Glory in the eyes of a young girl. A young girl. Find glory beyond the cheap colored lights. One song before the sun sets. Glory on another empty life. Time flies. Time dies. Song that rings true, truth like a blazing fire, an eternal flame. Find one song, a song about love, glory from the soul of a young man. A young man. Find the one song before the virus takes hold, glory like a sunset. One song to redeem this empty life.
We're coming full circle here, David. There's a reflection, you know, of the bohemian lifestyle in that song, too, that shows some regret. Do any of the characters in Puccini's opera have a similar moment?
Yeah, there's the lovers have a moment of regret. They agree to split up because they're not getting along, Rodolfo and Mimi. And it's the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, it's a terrible thing to be alone in winter. Let's split up in the spring instead. So they stay together a few more months, but they do split up eventually.
Well, the creator of Rent, Jonathan Larson, uses this story of struggling young artists in New York to highlight social issues too. In this case, HIV and AIDS. Is there any similar commentary in the original La Boheme?
Well, there is. I mean, the character Mimi has tuberculosis, which is the parallel with the character of Roger, who you just heard singing that song, who is HIV positive in the 90s mm-hmm. before, you know, it was a death sentence at the time, really. And, yeah, there's a couple of lines in the last act where they're trying to find some medication for Mimi, but there's no money. Mm-hmm. And one of the characters says, ah, miseria, poverty. It's such a terrible thing.
Hmm. How did you find your way into this world of opera?
Well, you know, it started with I sang in the church choir when I was 8, Episcopal Church, and we have wonderful music in that church. And then in high school, I started doing musicals. I realized when I got to college that opera is basically just musical theater from a different time and a different place.
That's interesting. We don't think of it that way, do we?
That's exactly what it is. If you lived in Italy in 1896, this would have been your popular entertainment, and it would have mattered to you just like musicals and films matter to us.
In the way it's the way people look at it, do you have problems with that? Because people look at it as something that's unapproachable so often.
I know. They think of it as elitist and so forth. But nowadays, right. We have projected titles above the stage, which gives you the English translation of what everyone is singing all the time. So you can follow the story and you can really get involved.
Well, that sounds great. The Lyric Opera of Kansas City presents four performances of La Boheme, November 9, 13, 15, and 17 at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. More information and for tickets, go to kcopera.org. David Charles Abell will be conducting the lyrics production of La Boheme. David, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve.
And good luck with
the
performance, okay?
Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, how student-led parent-teacher conferences help kids take ownership of their performance at school. You can hear that in previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, how right-wing extremists use social media to sway the narrative of American conversations. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.